Finally, available on video cassette.
The mono you're about to see is a construct of fact and fantasy. It was a secret fantasy for Vivato to put on the suit.
Thanks for the boogie ride. I'm more than gratified. I'm really satisfied, which only goes to prove you don't know until you glide into the boogie ride how quickly you will glide out of this world.
Troy Montez Michie was born in El Paso, Texas in 1985. A border town like El Paso is a natural mashup of cultures, traditions, languages, food, fashion, and nearly everything else. So it's no surprise that Troy turned his focus to collage, creating instantly recognizable works that combine magazine clippings, vintage pornography, images of the black male body, and lots of zoot suits. A style of clothing at the center of the 1943 zoot suit riots in Los Angeles, which was a series of attacks by whites on primarily Mexican-American, African-American, and Filipino-American youth. In Rock of Eye, the artist's first solo museum exhibition, these collages can be seen alongside drawings, sculptures, and installations. It's on view through September 4th at the California African-American Museum in LA, and if you're in our neck of the woods, Philbrook recently acquired one of Troy's collages titled Shadow and Act. It's up now and is a must-see. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential.
Congratulations on the big new survey. I'm sure that's kind of it's not just a big moment in your life, but also a big undertaking. Is it a relief in a way to have the show opened and having people see it? I'm sure the prep and installation process was pretty arduous.
Yes, thank you. It's something that had been postponed a number of times due to the pandemic, but it feels really good to have the show open and to see kind of what it became.
Yeah, so there were a lot of stops and starts, you know, wondering if and when this thing was actually going to happen.
Yes. Initially, I had been talking with Andrea Anderson from Rivers Project since, I think, about 2018. We had been talking about the idea of working together. And it was supposed to be kind of a show compiled of newer works. But ultimately, after we worked on the monograph or the museum catalog, it kind of became more apparent to me what the exhibition is going to become.
So the show is called Rock of Eye, which is a term I was not familiar with. It's a term that comes from the world of tailoring and cutting fabric. Can you talk to what that term means and how it applies to your work?
Sure. I've been researching a little bit about garment construction, and I came across this bespoke term for suit making called Rock of Eye. And it's basically kind of taking measurements of a body and kind of how a suit should fit or be draped just by eyesight.
So, you know, I was thinking about, we acquired a piece from you after our exhibition last year from The Limitation of Now. The piece is called Shadow and Act. And it's a, you know, very representative of the work you're doing now and certainly some of the work in this exhibition. And I was thinking about this Rock of Eye concept and looking at your work and the way you incorporate not just pre-existing images and photographs and magazine pieces, but the elements of thread and how you connect those pieces. And I wonder, as you stare and look at these works, you kind of stand back and look at them, there is this kind of quilting element that kind of reminds me of that when I see these threads, these literal threads that connecting. Do you feel that in the work? Is that an intention that you have, kind of looking at this idea of the connection between collage and quilting and some of those elements?
For sure. I mean, the sewing kind of came at a different phase of the project. So I started the Zoot Suit research and kind of interest in learning about the Pachuco culture, which originated in El Paso, Texas, but also and conjacent to that, this kind of theories that utilize camouflage that also started around the same time in maybe the early 1940s. So the sewing was something I had been thinking about, but I was a little intimidated as somebody who didn't really know much about sewing. But the more I kind of gravitated towards it, I started to realize that garment making has so much to do with the language of collage. And I was really struck by the whole kind of procedure of getting a sewing pattern, even though it's flat and instructional, it gives you kind of various lines. Those lines can be created or utilized to produce form. And it just made me think about like our own bodies.
Just on a real basic level, I'm curious, when you start incorporating something like sewing into your work and you hadn't before, there has to be some kind of learning curve to that. Is that something where, you know, you mess up some pieces early on, or you're trying to do something and you have to figure that out? Because, you're obviously making fairly big changes to a work when you start threading a needle through it and doing different things. Did that take some time to figure out how you were actually going to utilize that component?
I think more so in how do you use a sewing machine, a lot of trial and error. But even at that, I still don't really, I'm not well versed in, I guess, the proper way to piece garments together. But it became a way for me to think about line and drawing. So I use the machine to, it's almost like gestural, that type of line.
Yeah, kind of these zigs and zags and some of that. Yeah.
And I'm not very precious with my artworks as I'm making them. So it's almost like the thread becomes this attempt to repair or to hold something together, knowing that stitches may fall apart, like in clothing. And so I don't know, it just adds this other layer, I think, to the work.
So you grew up in El Paso. I've spent some time in El Paso, and it's very unique place. Obviously it's kind of unlike any other place in Texas. You know, you're mm-hmm. in Texas, but you're also obviously right on the border, so it's very much this hybrid of two different cultures. What was it like growing up? I'm just curious, you know, you don't meet a lot of people who end up where you are and kind of have that background. It obviously informs your work. Mm-hmm. You know, what does El Paso mean to you, kind of in your larger view of the world?
El Paso for me is still home. I think about just the trajectory of my art practice, being trained as a painter, always loving drawing since I was a kid. But now that I look through my practice, I start to see a lot of relations back to the community. So this idea of the Zoot Suit history, also kind of being raised in a highly militarized or sort of surveilled environment, but not really knowing that, because that was everything I knew until I left for grad school. But as I kind of started to go through some of these interests, like with camouflage per se, I was like, oh yeah, Fort Bliss is there, which is, I think, the largest US Army base. And I grew up seeing soldiers in camouflage my whole life. But then also, I do think it's an interesting experience to be living with people, I guess, from Mexico, but also being divided by these fences and lines and barriers and border patrol. So it is kind of this, there's like a sense of duality. And I attribute that kind of hybridized upbringing, also being Mexican-American, to maybe an interest in collage, like kind of taking disparate materials to make something new.
When you were, you know, you went to UTEP, right? And then went on to Yale. Was it always collage for you? I'm just curious if it was always collage, because obviously you have a great skill at drawing and other practices too, but was there a moment when it kind of clicked in that this was going to be the pursuit in some way?
It didn't click in fully till grad school, but I really value my undergraduate education. I had amazing professors with amazing facilities. It took me a while to figure out I wanted to study art, because I was into architecture. I was into design. And I ultimately wanted to pursue a drawing major. But in my mind, I had thought if you major in drawing, like you can't be an artist. So I had switched to painting. But when I was painting, it seemed like I always had to do something. So I kind of remember now that I used to do a lot of portraits from photographs of family members. So I would sew things or just kind of like thread into the portraits. I'd cut out, do a lot of magazine cutouts, but it didn't really come to a point till I went to grad school and I kind of was like, oh, I can just make collage as an art form, and it doesn't necessarily have to be in the realm of painting or drawing, but it, of course it is.
You know, one of the things that I'm always interested in with artists who pursue collage or different pieces using found material is the idea that it turns you into kind of a scavenger and how it changes the way you look at the world. And I wonder if you see the world as kind of a constant hunt for materials, if the way you're looking at, you know, you see a box of things on the road, or you see, you know, are you always kind of somehow looking for things, whether it's conscious or not?
I would say yes. I think as a collage artist, there's this sense of being an observer, but also like a curiousness to materiality or surfaces. Like when I think about El Paso, I just think about the light. Like there's such like this harsh kind of light in the way it reflects off the sand. But I used to just love seeing these kind of like scrap materials that you would see that had been bleached by the sun or some type of degradation due to heat exposure and dryness. But even in New York, like I'm constantly seeing new things in terms of buildings and architecture. And yet there's always kind of a place for inspiration.
Yeah, it seems like you're kind of, it kind of forces you to become kind of an anthropologist and kind of an explorer of certain kind of things. You mentioned the brittleness of some of these materials when you find them, you know, if you find a magazine that's been browned by the sun and turned into this crispy material. The collages themselves obviously are affected by time. How do you think about, I'm just curious how you think about the preservation of these works. Once you finish them, do they take extra care that, say, a painting would not? Is that a concern?
They're pretty durable, and it's kind of interesting. So a lot of my, I don't know, during the pandemic, I feel like I learned so much about my practice during this forced kind of solitary time. And I've always been drawn to analog material, and being an older millennial, so much of my reference to pop culture came from magazines. But as a kid, I was so into like sci-fi film, horror film, but posters, like the language of advertisement. And there seems to be kind of this reoccurring thing with me with the archive. Like I'm really interested in this idea of taking information from a printed publication. So some of them are found, a lot of them are sourced, and they're dead stock materials. But I think through the different variations or methods in the studio, it's almost like I'm adding my own layer or history into them by painting over them or drawing or sanding them, sewing into them. So that they become pretty durable, because I'm working from wall to floor and everything gets sealed with an inarchival glue. And that, I think that just comes from a lot of these earlier collage works that I see in museums. They aren't shown that often. And I think it's because they're light sensitive due to the paper.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Found Objects, tires, blankets, coffee cups, bottle caps, roadkill, darn near everything or anything can be added to or elevated to a work of art. A urinal? Yes. What about a snow shovel? Yes, that too. If you can find it, you can make it art. You can make it a found object. It's just that simple. Additional support provided by the Found Objects Guild of Eastern Oklahoma.
You mentioned Zoot Suits. That plays a big role in your work and certainly in this exhibition. I was trying to think kind of what the cultural reference points to Zoot Suits are for people. There was this swing revival in the 1990s, and there was a popular song called Zoot Suit Riot, which is not particularly interesting, but certainly a phrase, certainly a phrase people were hearing maybe for the first time and didn't know what that was. I don't really think it was particularly referencing the historical content that you're dealing with here, but it's a term. And then I think back to things like Tex Avery cartoons and use of Zoot Suits, and then even things like I was watching Spike Lee's Malcolm X recently, and at the beginning of it, when you see Malcolm Little, he's kind of wearing these larger Zoot Suits and kind of looking at them. Where did the interest come for this culture, and how did it land on your, being an older millennial, Zoot Suits aren't necessarily something that you grew up experiencing. How did you kind of come across that?
I mean, I did because it's that particular subculture started in El Paso. I was always aware of it. So I always saw that suit. It's pretty common for people to have them made for like quinceañeras or for special occasions. And often they would cover that history in school, but I didn't really focus on it until 2016. And I was visiting home and I had a conversation with my dad, and he started to just talk about the Zoot Suit and a particular Mexican movie star named Tintan, who was famous for doing this dance called the Pachuco Boogie. And so I was like, huh. So I kind of just started to look more into that. And I was just shocked because it was something that was around. But once I focused on it, it had just this amazing history that already covered so many issues in my work that I was already interested in. So being kind of the first American garment predominantly worn by people of color, but also being criminalized, I thought was strange, and starting a race riot, even though it wasn't termed as that, it was based on like World War II rationing. So
this was in 1943, right in the middle of the war in Los Angeles, right?
It was a little bit earlier. So it didn't have a very long, I don't know how you would say that. I guess it has had a long lineage because people still wear it today, but I would say like early 1930s, but it kind of reached its height in the 40s when the riots happened. So once the suit started to become illegal to make, then that's kind of when it put a stop to it.
It's interesting, the idea of it's certainly true now. I think people are certainly judged by what they wear and how they wear things, but the idea that this was connected with a criminal mentality, or that it was othering in some way, or dangerous to the white establishment or anyone who was looking at that. And also the fact that it kind of crossed over into the Hispanic population, but also into the African-American population. And, certainly became, we were mentioning like, the Harlem Renaissance, and there are elements of that there too. Why do you think that this fashion spread so widely? I think that's one, beyond just the controversy of it, it became so widespread and moved from, say, getting from El Paso to Harlem is an interesting journey, right? That doesn't happen for everything.
It spread through the jazz craze. So I think in the research and books that I've read, they don't know exactly who first created the Zoot Suit, but Cab Calloway was definitely wearing that. So once the jazz craze kind of spread out through the country, it started to be in more prominence, and also because it had a function. So the suit did appear that way because if you were doing swing dancing and kicks, like you needed extra room in the pants so the seams wouldn't split.
It's like hammer pants,
Yeah, exactly. And I think with Pachuco culture, it just kind of really became this symbol for these first generation Americans to kind of develop their own identity, because a lot of the other generation that had just kind of immigrated over, it was all about assimilation. So even like these first generation Mexican people were not, like even their own families were kind of like, don't dress like that. You're going to draw attention to yourself. You're supposed to appear to be American and kind of assimilate.
Yeah.
So that's something I was really interested in terms of collage and subcultures, and that often these youth movements that are affiliated with music and fashion, they are a collage when they're taking certain materials out of context and appropriating it to become something new.
I'd like to kind of conclude our conversation by talking about your personal style, because one of the things that I think is so fascinating about your work is that you've landed on a style of work that I think is very, very recognizable. And when I see your work, I know it's your work. And I think for a lot of artists, to me, that seems like the hardest thing to do, where you can create a visual language that becomes a personal language and it becomes known to the eye, right? And it's very difficult. Did that take you time to land on this style? And of course, you know, if we're talking 10 years from now or 20 years from now, we might have a totally different body of work that is not representative of the work we're seeing in this show. But right now, there is very much a Troy, you know, style and look. But it can't have always been that way. So when did you begin to shape that?
I feel like that's an interesting question. Maybe, I don't know. The nice thing about Rock of I is that the earliest work, I think, in there is from 2014. And right after grad school, it was just kind of like, I'd moved to New York City and I was trying to just make work as I could and afford studio space. But with Rock of I, I can see elements. So it's almost like pieces were being revealed. So I've always had an interest in the figure, photography, portraiture, printed language. And it is kind of interesting to see that thread, because even at that time when it didn't feel like it was anything, I see what I'm doing now and I'm like, oh, like you've kind of been interested in this for a while. But I don't know, I guess I haven't thought about style in that sense, but I don't know, it's good to hear that.
I guess I think of it almost the way, you know, a writer has a voice. And the thing is, usually the voice is not apparent to the writer. It's apparent to the reader, right? And now looking back at your work, you're saying, hey, you can kind of start to see it, but you couldn't see it in the moment. And you wouldn't. That's not your job, in a way. Final question is about kind of jumping a little bit back on the collaging. And as when you see a magazine or a piece that you think is going to be part of a collage, can an entire work be spawned off of one image like that? When you see something, does the whole start to piece itself together? Or you say, hey, this is going to be the seed that begins a larger project. Can a single page from a magazine or some piece that goes in the collage start the snowball rolling down the hill like that?
I think definitely. There's one thing I think that's been a powerful tool post school is just trusting intuition. So a lot of times I'm drawn to an image or a material and I just hold on to it. And I know over time it'll be revealed, but yeah, it's almost like I do storyboarding as well and collecting. And I mean, there's a lot of different projects. I'll be like, oh, like you can save this for that back burner project. And I will say that reading and literature is super crucial for me, and that helps spark a lot of ideas.
In 1956, English artist Richard Hamilton created a collage titled, Just What Is It That Makes Today's Home So Different, So Appealing? The collage consists of images taken mainly from then-current American magazines aimed at women, most notably an ad for Armstrong Floors from Ladies' Home Journal. The title was also derived from the ad, which read, quote, Just what is it that makes today's home so different, so appealing? Open planning, of course, and a bold use of color. End quote. Hamilton's collage was one of the earliest examples of pop art to reach a wide audience. Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Theme music by Broncho. For more on the museum and the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.